What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Was that if you were going to mess around with very complicated and dangerous matters, that's a good way of putting it, that you should really put your life together. And so I would say the right way to deal with your neuroticism is to increase your conscientiousness, because we also know that the higher your conscientiousness, the lower your neuroticism. Conscientiousness does seem to keep neuroticism in check. And so I would say, and have said this to many people, clean your room, organize your life, like, get a routine, get up every day at the same time, go to bed at the same time, establish disciplined habits. And that will help a lot. Schedule, like, and here's how to use a schedule. Use a calendar, use Google Calendar, but don't use it as a tyrant. You know, you want to use a calendar as if it's your confidant and advisor. And what you want to do is use the calendar, sit down and open the calendar and think, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to design a week of days that I would really like to have. So what that would mean then is that you would schedule things that you would consider meaningful and productive, you know, on a daily basis, so that you feel that your life is justified by having a day like that, and also to schedule enough of your responsibilities so that you make progress day by day instead of falling farther behind. And what that'll do is, it doesn't directly affect your neurophysiology, but you know, you're reacting as a neurotic person, a person high in neuroticism, say, you react to uncertainty and the unexpected with more physiological preparedness and more expenditure of energy than the typical person. And so what you want to do is organize your surroundings, because it's a lot easier to organize your surroundings, at least to begin with, than it is to do radical reconstruction on your fundamental temperament, which you might not be able to do at all. So I would say discipline. And the other thing I would say for creative people, and this is true for people in general, but it's really important for creative people, is that if you want to be creative, which is very, very dangerous and very, very unlikely to succeed, although absolutely necessary if you happen to be high in openness, is that you should organize the rest of your life, except for your creative endeavors, in a pretty traditional and conservative manner, if you can do that. Because what that does is buttress you against the unexpected and give you some stability on many, you know, along many of the potential dimensions of your life. And that frees you up to take larger risks in the creative domain. Now, it's hard for creative people to do that because they're sort of blasting out, you know, laterally in all directions simultaneously. But you exhaust yourself that way, and you also risk scattering yourself. Louis Watterson here had a question. How would you suggest someone who's a jack of all trades and master of none conduct themselves? Well, you're probably high in openness, high in creativity. And one of the dangers of being high in creativity, especially if you're also high in neuroticism, is that it's hard for creative people to catalyze an identity, because they're basically Pan-like, you know, like Peter Pan, or like Pan, which means everything. The god of the forest is the god of everything to some degree. And the problem with being everything is that you're also nothing at the same time, because you never specialize. And so I would say that if you're, I think that being a jack of all trades is pretty damn useful, but I would also say that it's really necessary to buckle down and find one primary mode of discipline. And Jack or Louis, if you can't figure out what you should do, then guess. Just pick something that you think that you could hit hard and concentrate on. You don't have to be perfect at it. You don't even have to get it right. But pick something rather than nothing, or pick something rather than all things, and then set yourself to master that. Because, you know, you need to have a primary discipline. It's absolutely necessary to succeed in life. Now, once you have a primary discipline, then you can branch out and become a multiplicity in your disciplined approach, and then you're absolutely bloody unstoppable. But you really need that initial disciplinary routine. You know, this is something Nietzsche knew very well. He said, for example, I just wrote about this today, that it was the long unfreedom of Europe's subjugation to the dogmatic structures of the Catholic Church that ennobled the European mind and gave it the capacity to widely range that it eventually developed. But it was that initial subjugation, that initial voluntary slavery that produced the discipline, that produced the spirit that could then go out and do other things. And it's really, really useful to subjugate yourself to something voluntarily. You know, I think that's partly why it's useful to practice a religious faith, because you subject yourself to a disciplinary structure that way. And you might think, well, that's all oppressive and all of that. And of course, that's true. But it also makes you disciplined. And once you're disciplined, like you're like a sharpened sword, man, like a well-tempered blade. And then you can go out there and operate in the world. So, and if you haven't found your passion, then I would say, well, don't wait around till you find the damn thing, because you may never find it. Is pick something and focus on it, you know. And if you move strongly and forthrightly towards it for a number of months at least, or even a number of years, and then you find, well, that wasn't the thing for you, it isn't going to be a waste anyways, because most of the time, the pursuit of any disciplined knowledge pays off, even if it doesn't pay off in the way that you initially expect. What is my opinion on open relationships, polyamory, other forms of non-monogamy? Well, I think that as a medium to long-term strategy, they're completely untenable, because human beings, as far as I'm concerned, are fundamentally pair bonding. And, you know, if you're just talking about casual sex, first of all, I think casual sex is a contradiction in terms. I don't think there's anything about sex that's casual, and I think that people are deceiving themselves badly whenever they think so. They might like to live in a, you know, 1970s Playboy adolescent fantasy, but I've never seen that work under any circumstances whatsoever, and I think people get hurt badly. It's also a bad medium to long-term strategy, because, you know, pair bonding is the most stable arrangement we know of, at least so far. Well, I won't even put it that way. It's the only stable mode of being that we know for the long run. And that's especially the case when you bring children into the equation. So I think it's delusional fundamentally. And I think that people who believe that such things work, I mean, sometimes they're open people and they're creative and they're exploratory and all of that, and fair enough. But often they're just unconscientious and they don't want to take any responsibility, and they want to live in this wish fulfillment fantasy where everybody can have all the sex they want all the time and it's always wonderful and no one gets hurt. And it's like, sorry, that just doesn't work in the real world. So, my girlfriend is quite overweight, but I really love her. Should I try to encourage her to lose weight? Aside from personal preference, is this likely to explode into a major issue down the road? I don't think that you can fool yourself about what you're attracted to. And yes, it's certainly likely to develop into a major issue down the road. It's tough, you know, because the devil's in the details. You know, should you try to encourage her to lose weight? I guess the question is, how would you do that without disrupting the relationship? And without knowing more about the details of that, I would say that I don't know what to tell you to do about that. I think that it's necessary to be truthful in a relationship, period. But I also think that you can't use the truth to hurt. You know, the truth is a very complicated thing, and it's a sword, and it cuts, and you can't use it to hurt. Now, you know, maybe you would be subtle enough to figure out some way that you could both embark on a health-promoting endeavor together, and that would work out. But I would say, you know, if you're in a stable long-term relationship with someone, it's pretty much necessary for both of you to address all the issues that are making you unhappy with each other, you know, assuming there's some give and take on that, because otherwise the relationship can easily come apart at the seams. Like, I would say my wife and I are both very hard on each other about our physical appearance, let's say, and I'd gained a fair bit of weight from the time I was, say, 40 till the time I was 50, about probably because I was eating things that weren't good for me, and I would say that was primarily carbohydrates. I can tell you, if you want to lose weight, you stop eating carbohydrates, man, you'll lose weight like you wouldn't believe. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it because it has some dangers, but it certainly works. But, you know, the alternative to The alternative is to pretend that everything's all right, and all that means is that you're likely to get drunk sometimes and someday and have an affair out of bitterness and spite and the fact that you're no longer attracted to your partner. So it's pretty rough. So that's a pretty rough way of thinking about things, but life's pretty rough. So,
well, you know, there used to be, before the divorce laws were really liberalized, you could sue for irreconcilable differences. And sometimes people do find themselves in that situation. It's like one person wants children and the other person doesn't. It's like, that's a tough one. It's a tough one to negotiate. So I'm certainly not saying that just because you lock yourself into a, like two cats in a barrel, that will make you solve your problems, because problems are hard to solve and sometimes you can't solve them. I was just pointing out what the cost of leaving the back door, what the cost of leaving the back door open is, and it's a big cost. And you know, one of the things I see too is that people's identities fragment increasingly across time. You know, one of the things that you have as you age is something like the continuity of your life. You know, you have someone that you're with, you've tied your story together with theirs. You have children, maybe they have children. It's like there's this continual payoff, so to speak, in quality that you obtain from staying within that frame. And you can jump out of that. And I suppose to some degree that provides freedom, but it isn't obvious to me that it does that for people.
But you're assuming that one specific relationship is high quality. It may not be.
No, but it's also the case that sequential relationships are unlikely to be that. So, look, I'm definitely not making a utopian case for marriage. So,
I would like to hear the case for divorce from you, because it'd be really interesting, right? It's a strong point, but at the same time, I think there are some relationships that are really low quality.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then insisting on them cannot be good.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the alternative argument. And of course, there are strong things to be said on both sides. But see, there's some additional problems with divorce that people don't really grasp when they're young. Like, the idea that you can be divorced once you have children, that's kind of a stupid idea, because you can't. You can find a limited substitute for your initial freedom. But if you have kids and you try to get divorced, the probability that that's going to demolish your life is very, very high. First of all, it's incredibly expensive. So one or both of you is going to come out of that poor. And your market value has declined. Let's say you're the woman who takes the kids. Your market value has declined radically. You're going to be poorer. The man, he's just as screwed, because he is now an indentured servant and there's no escape from it.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
So it's And it's not so bad if you can negotiate a peaceful separation, and some people can, but lots of times if you have a terrible relationship, it's not like negotiating a peaceful separation is all that easy. But if you're at each other's throats, good luck to you. I think it's roughly equivalent to having non-fatal cancer. It is not pleasant. It's a 10-year process, 15-year process. It'll cost you $250,000, and it'll tear a big chunk out of your life. And also, it will really disrupt your relationship with your kids. And, you know, you bring kids into a step-parent family, they do not do as well. Step-parents are not as good parents as biological parents, and the data on that is clear. Now, obviously, there are exceptions, because there are terrible biological parents, and there are wonderful step-parents. But if you look in aggregate, it's not that easy to care for children. You need everything you can binding you to them. And if they're someone else's children, mostly they get in the way of the person that you love. Right? Well, if I'm, let's say you have a child, I'll be right out. Let's say you have a child and I want to go out with you. Every second you spend with that child is the second you don't spend with me. And there's going to be a price for that. I'm not going to be happy about that. And if I have a child, you're going to feel exactly the same way. You might say, well, no, I love children. It's like, yeah, yeah, sure. Sure you do. I doubt it. You might love your child. And you know, it's pretty specific the way that people love children. So, and the rate of abuse for kids in step-parent families is way higher than it is in biological families. There's not even any comparison. So, anyways.
I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and of course the women in my class, and perhaps some of the women online too, are irritated or put off or maybe just alienated, and perhaps properly so, by the fact that the archetypal hero is masculine. Now, there's complex reasons for that, and I would recommend for those who are actually interested in such things to read Eric Neumann's The Origins and History of Consciousness and also The Great Mother, which are two great works of Jungian psychology. Camille Paglia, by the way, is a big fan of both of those books, for those of you who might be interested, because Neumann does the best job that I know of describing why the symbolism of the hero is laid out the way it is, why Mother Nature is mother, feminine, and why the hero is masculine. Now, but here's how I've come to understand it, and I'm going to use Christian symbolic language because it's the quickest, it's the shortest route to this sort of explanation. So I would say that in the male psyche, the dragon slaying hero is at the forefront, and so that would be Christ in the archetypal mode, because this dragon he defeats is the evil that is encompassed in within the figure of Satan. So that'd be like the ultimate dragon. And then behind that is the feminine, the compassionate, the caring, and that would be embodied, say, in the Christian figure of Mary. So you have in both male, in the male and female soul, let's say you have Christ and Mary, but in the male, Christ is foremost, that's the dragon slayer, we'll say, and Mary is the secondary character. And although both should be very well developed, and that makes for a much better character. And in the female, it's the other way around, is that the maternal slash feminine, so let's say Mary, is at the forefront, and Christ is in the background, the dragon slayer is at the background, but should be well developed. Jung felt that, you know, it was possible for men to develop the more feminine side of themselves, especially in the last half of life, which is also when he felt that women should develop the more masculine side of themselves. And, you know, we could debate that, but it's a perfectly reasonable proposition. Now, we should note that the figure of Mary is actually a heroic figure in and of itself, because, like, you can really understand this if you look at Michelangelo's Pieta. So in that great sculpture, you see Mary, who's holding the crucified Christ, and that's basically her son, right? Her son, who's just been offered up to the world and betrayed by his friends and broken on the cross. And in other words, he's been subject to the worst that life can throw at him. And the thing about Mary is that she knew initially, when she agreed to give birth to the Savior of mankind, that he would be broken. And that's an archetypal story, because women know in their heart of hearts that their children are going to be broken and killed by the world. That's the human condition. And so there's and of course, a woman who's well developed loves her child more than herself, loves her child more than anyone else, which is something you can't really understand till you've had a child, but is still willing to bring that child into the world, knowing full well what his or her fate will be. And so there's a real heroism in that. And so, and then there's the standard heroism that a woman can undertake where she develops her masculine side, which is basically what happens, for example, in Sleeping Beauty. When Sleeping Beauty is awakened by the prince's kiss, you can think of that, you can think of her being rescued by an actual man, but you can also think of that as the masculine part of her psyche waking up her unconscious femininity so that the two of them can unite and rule the kingdom. It's perfectly reasonable interpretation of that story. And so that would be the development of the masculine side in a female, the side that's stalwart and forthright and willing to go forth into the world and conquer uncertainty. And then there's the Beauty and the Beast archetype, which I think is in some sense the primary female sexual archetype. And Beauty and the Beast is another kind of dragon slaying story. It's more like a dragon taming story, I suppose, where the woman, the virginal woman who's out for an adventure, finds a beastly male. And that's the dangerous man that I was talking about earlier, right? The man who has the capacity, say, to kill, the capacity to harm, the capacity for violence at hand, right? At hand. And then proceeds to tame him, which is a real adventure. And, you know, we know that this is the case because, again, we can refer to those, you know, those rom-coms that are so popular now with the failed beta males always trying to make friends with the girl and failing. The girls are interested in the rough guys who have the capacity to also be sophisticated and to be, let's not say tamed, but civilized into channeling their harsh roughness, their capacity for evil even, into productive competition and because competition can be very productive, and then the sharing forth of the fruits of that competition with family. And so those are all heroic aspects of feminine being, and they're not to be taken lightly. They're major life tasks and major life contributions, you know. And I guess another part of the heroic element of the female is the subjugation of her own primacy with regards to her child, because my daughter just had a child, by the way, so I'm a grandfather, so hooray for that. And it went really nicely, and I'm so happy about that because A, I love my daughter, and B, I really, really like kids. I think they're so great. And so now I'm going to have a kid around again. So that's great. But I mean, you know, one of the things you notice very rapidly if you're a parent is that you bring someone into the world who's now more important under all circumstances than you are. And there's a heroic subjugation of selfishness that goes along with that. That's characteristic, deeply characteristic of the properly developed feminine spirit.
Inducing disgust responses, whether via a foul odor, a disgusting work environment, or recalling a disgusting experience, led individuals to assign harsher punishments to others who had committed moral transgressions. So you describe a moral transgression, maybe breaking a law, you expose the people in the experiment to some disgusting stimulus, and then you ask them about the probability that the person was guilty, and then also how long they should be imprisoned or how much they should be fined. And if you get the people disgusted, then the probability, especially if they're orderly, then the probability of assigning a harsh punishment goes upward. So if you're ever in court, don't disgust the judge, right? That's part of the deal. Harsher moral judgments can even be induced following the consumption of a bitter drink, because bitter substances are often poison, or poisonous substances are often bitter, and that induces a disgust response as well. Although you can overcome that. Coffee is bitter, olives are bitter, so you can retrain your system to accept those things as food, but it's not particularly easy. In addition, the same disgust-related facial expressions are observed in response to unpleasant tastes, disgusting photographs, and receiving unfair treatment in an economic game. Concerns about cleanliness, and interesting, so some of you may know I was at McMaster University a couple of weeks ago, and there were a bunch of protesters there, and I went up to meet the protesters because I kind of wanted to see what would happen. There were a bunch of them around the back of the room, and I offered to shake their hands, and mostly what I got was disgust faces, you know, and that's not good. That's not good. So here's something to know too. Here's a good predictor of whether or not you're going to get divorced. You go into the therapist's office and you talk, the two of you talk, and you roll your eyes. That'll predict. If you're rolling your eyes at your partner, you're going to divorce them. Why? It's a disgust response, right? It's something like, I'm lifting you up with my eyes and throwing you into the garbage. It's something like that. But eye rolling is a great predictor of the probability of divorce. So it's something to keep in mind with regards to your relationships. Like if you're starting to develop some contempt or some disgust,
you bloody well better get on that right away, because that's a bad road to go down. And so, so then you have to do whatever you have to do not to go down that road. Concerns about cleanliness and feelings of disgust have likewise been related to political attitudes. Situational reminders of the importance of physical cleanliness, such as asking participants to wipe their hands with antiseptic wipes, tend to increase self-reported political conservatism. Such as finding is consistent with the notion that purity tends to be valued more highly by conservatives than by liberals. Individuals who report being disgusted more easily also tend to hold more conservative political views on topics including abortion, gay marriage, tax cuts, and affirmative action. In addition to the effects that have emerged when using self-reported disgust sensitivity, more conservative political views have also been associated with stronger physiological reactivity to disgusting images. There's a lawyer, Martha Nussbaum, who's also a political philosopher, who says that we should eliminate the effect of disgust on our political theorizing, that disgust shouldn't be something that's considered as a valid means of information from which you might derive political conclusions. So if I find your behavior disgusting, or if you find my behavior disgusting, according to Nussbaum, that should be independent. You should try to make that rationally independent of your political views. I'd like to believe that, but there's a problem, and this is the problem that we're going to go through. You can't muck about with these underlying systems. You can't just say, ignore the reports of your disgust system, because it isn't like your emotions are insane and irrational and you have the rationality on top of that that's guiding you properly. That isn't how it works. All of these underlying biological systems guide you, and to the degree that you're the degree to which you're guided properly is a consequence of the balance of the action of these underlying biological systems, but the balance is very complexly maintained. You need a disgust system, because if you didn't, you'd eat something that would kill you, and then you would die, or you'd do something stupid, and you'd end up, like, you'd get cut, and it would be dirty, and you wouldn't clean it, and then you would die. So the idea that you can somehow just rationalize the output of the disgust system and decontaminate your political viewpoints as a consequence seems to me to be very, very naive. Not that there's no danger to it, because there's plenty of danger.
This isn't just a game, it's a once in a generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.